Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show. Welcome back a friend of the show, a friend of mine, Phil Kirpin. Phil is here from American Commitment, and he is the president of American Commitment, and he is all over this topic of ACA subsidies. This is the hot topic of the moment, not hot topic in the sense that Phil and I shop at Hot Topic, by the way. We're a little out of the...
That's still around.
We're a little, I have no idea, to be honest.
Right. I don't know.
We're a little out of the demographic for Hot Topic, the shop. But no doubt, the ACA subsidies are the hot topic at the moment. Politically speaking, this was the one of the issues that was brought up during the shutdown. You know, I think we both realize that this was just Democrats trying to do some muscle flexing, and it didn't really work out well for them. But look, I think that the subsidies are likely to get some sort of attention here, because I think that Republicans are a little afraid of the expiration date on the expanded subsidies that were passed over your objection, my objection during the pandemic, because we knew what would happen, which is that they would become permanent. And that is what Democrats want to do. And I think a few Republicans may want to do it as well, Phil, and it's a really bad idea.
Yeah, Republican Mike Flood from Nebraska is pushing very hard, basically for Republicans to cave on this, which, you know, there's always some group. There's always a handful of them, much more so among Republicans than among Democrats. There are always some people that want to lead with compromise or surrender. First of all, let me explain what the enhanced subsidies are, even though your audience
yes.
probably knows, just because they've been mischaracterized a lot. The original Obamacare subsidy structure, the permanent Obamacare subsidy structure, it has subsidies based on income. And so it's a sliding scale. The less you make, the lower a percentage of your income you're expected to pay towards premiums. On the original subsidy scale, if you're under 150% of the federal poverty level, you only pay 2% of your income. Taxpayers pick up the rest. And it goes all the way up to 400% of the poverty level with an increase. And then at 400, it's cut off. And so people who made over 400% of the federal poverty level couldn't get subsidies under the original structure. What they did during COVID is they said, oh my God, we've got to make sure that we have as many people as possible that are getting it. It actually had almost nothing to do with COVID. They used it as an excuse more than anything
right.
else, because you're already starting to see sort of spiraling premiums, and the number of people that weren't subsidized that actually were buying these policies was very small. But they said, oh my God, because of the COVID emergency, we need to expand these subsidies. And there were two major changes to this structure. One is they got rid of the income limit. So instead of saying 400% of the poverty level is the limit, they said there is no limit. Instead, no matter how much money you make, you don't have to pay more than 8.5% of your income towards premiums, and taxpayers will pick up the rest. And so in some high cost areas, you have people who are making, you know, literally $200,000 a year, but they're getting subsidies because, you know, the 8.5% doesn't cover whatever the premium is. And that's there was no income cap at the bottom end. And this was another huge problem. They changed it from 2% to zero. And so we got millions of people who signed up or were signed up by some unscrupulous person. There have now been some prosecutions about brokers who were just committing mass fraud, signing people up to get the commissions. When something is zero, when there's a zero payment associated with something, it's a recipe for a lot of mischief compared to even a very small payment. The 2% payment was not very much. We're talking $5 a week, something like that, depending on what your income is. But 2% of income is not a lot, especially because you're talking very low income people and a very low
right.
percentage. But when you go to zero, it causes a huge number of problems. And in fact, millions of people who were signed up who filed no claims, who didn't use the free preventive care or any of the other stuff. And so they might not exist. They might not know they're signed up. They might have just done it because someone asked them to, who was a friend who wanted the commission, but they don't even care. They don't use it. They don't value it at all. But taxpayers pay a huge amount of money for that. And so if these expire, these enhanced subsidies, they were originally for 3 years. They extended it 2 more years in Inflation Reduction Act. If these expire, it's not no more subsidies, okay? It's we go back to the original structure.
Go
the
back,
original
yeah,
structure
back,
is impermanent.
I mean, this is a really key point, is that, you know, Democrats are saying, oh, you're going to take health care away from people. The people who are getting the expanded subsidies were people who have larger incomes, higher
yeah,
income
at the top
space.
End. And at the bottom end, it's people who either don't exist or don't value this coverage enough to pay even a couple of dollars a week. And so
right.
it's that's primarily who we're talking about. The Democrats, first of all, I think miscalculated badly. If they wanted to make this the issue in the shutdown, they shouldn't have had five other issues in their bill, including, you know, repealing One Big Beautiful Bill's eligibility checks, because then they said got caught in the immigration issue and all these other things. But they did kind of zero in on this towards the end, this idea of we've got to extend these enhanced subsidies because nobody can afford Obamacare plans without subsidies. And then you kind of have to scratch your head and say, well, doesn't that mean that your plan failed, that it's in a death spiral, that premiums are out of control? If even, you know, middle and upper income people need subsidies, something gone very, very badly wrong. But I think the, you know, the bad news is you're probably right that they'll do something on healthcare that may include an extension of some form of these subsidies. The good news is I think there's basically no chance that it's just a straight line extension of what we have right now. I think that by making it a huge partisan issue and a key point in the shutdown talks, almost all Republicans will now reject a straight extension, which might have been the default had they not really polarized the issue, because it's hard to actually get Republicans to pay attention to healthcare and care about this. But Democrats kind of did that for us. So I think where we are now is we're likely to see a healthcare bill, but I'm cautiously optimistic it may have some positive things in it, especially with the president pushing very hard for expanding health savings accounts and bringing more choice and competition in, more price transparency, more of a functioning marketplace, as opposed to the money just going directly to insurance companies and kind of the incentive to just have ever higher premiums.
Yeah, this is what Trump has been talking about too, right? Because the way that this is structured at the moment is that these are, they're subsidies. They don't get paid directly to the people who are signing up for the healthcare insurance. They get paid to the insurance companies to subsidize the charges that they would normally pass along to the consumers, right? So these subsidies are actually directly going to the insurance companies. And this is one of the reasons why the insurance companies are making this an issue, right? Is because they got more money out of this.
They get a huge amount of money. I mean, you look at the stocks of any of the insurance companies, they've gone to the moon since Obamacare passed, and they've gone almost vertical since the enhanced subsidies. They've done very, very well. So I know why they want it. And I know why the large hospital systems want it too, because we've just seen this mass consolidation of healthcare in this country, and the money flows into the insurance companies, and then a significant portion of it ends up in these big health systems, and everything's become so bureaucratized. And what I've been telling Republicans is, look, you have a huge opportunity now in healthcare. Be the party that wants to bring back private practice physicians, that wants to bring back real choice and competition, that wants to, you know, end this totally destructive consolidation trend, which has all been driven by federal payment policies and federal regulations. And, you know, I think there's a huge opportunity here. And I would even preempt a lot of the state rules and regulations. I know some conservatives aren't quite there yet, but I think the state certificate of need laws, which tons of states still have, where you can't build a surgical center or a hospital unless the incumbent hospital gives you permission to compete with them. I mean, in some of these states, like West Virginia, you can't build anything. So, I mean, you have these horrible supply restrictions that drive prices up. And the insurance companies under Obamacare, they make more money when prices are high because they've got this regulation called medical loss ratio, where they've got to pay out 80% of the premium dollars that they bring in claims. And so they don't make more money unless they're paying out more in claims. So they respond to that in two ways. First of all, they actually do better when their prices are higher for hospital services and other things, which is a bad incentive, but also they've just gobbled up physicians' practices, gobbled up other kinds of providers.
We've talked about this before. Gobbled up pharmacies.
And now now it's all transfer pricing, which they can game the heck out of. And so we've driven this massive consolidation trend, which I don't know anyone who likes it. I don't know anyone who likes it. Before Obamacare passed, 15% of physicians' practices in this country had corporate ownership. Now it's 60%. They're owned by hospitals, they're owned by insurance companies, they're owned by some private equity group that can deal with all the regulations and the nonsense. And we're making it so difficult to just be in private practice.
Well, this is one of the issues that I brought up during the original debate, right? Which was that there was actually a model for a healthy and rational health services market where there was two of them. One was elective cosmetic surgery and the other one was LASIK, right? Because insurance doesn't cover either of those. And so you can look up prices. You had clear price signaling to the consumer. You didn't have third-party intervention. You didn't have the massive overhead that insurance requires, especially comprehensive insurance requires. So you'd be in network and comply with this and negotiate on this price and that price and all this kind of stuff. And so what happens is you get a lot of providers that are going into those. You know, you got a lot of people who are specializing in these fields so that they don't have to deal with insurance companies and they can bill directly to consumers. And because you have all that supply, the price is pretty stable for these things. It's competitive.
What I would love to see, and I think the president and a lot of the Republicans are leaning in this direction, but what I would really love to see is hugely expanded health savings accounts. So if your employer wants to put a huge amount of money in there for you, instead of buying an employer plan, they can. If you want to put a big amount of money in there, you can. If we have federal subsidies of any form, they should go into that. And then you deregulate the insurance market so that we can bring back traditional major medical type indemnity, catastrophic type plans where you can buy relatively inexpensively to insure against, God forbid, if you get cancer, you have hospitalization, you have an emergency situation, you need a surgery, those sort of, you know, unlikely but super high ticket events. I think most people want to carry insurance for that. But for your day-to-day stuff, if you can get the same tax benefit out of an account, you should be shopping around. You should be paying out of pocket, out of the account for that day to day with a real functional marketplace with transparency and competition. Or if you want, and this should be an option too, you should subscribe for a direct primary care relationship where you have a doctor who covers, you know, all your visits, all your day to day stuff for some fixed monthly fee. And there are a lot of providers that are doing this now. And by the way, most people who are signing up for this kind of thing now are sort of double paying because they also have a traditional insurance product that complies with all the Obamacare regulations. But I think we could say, look, we're going to direct the tax benefits to these accounts so people have ownership and control. We're going to deregulate insurance products so that you can insure against those, you know, those catastrophic type events. We're not expecting people to pay for those out of an account or out of pocket. But for the other stuff, for the day-to-day stuff, the equivalent of your oil changes or your new tires or whatever it is, you know, you should either be shopping around and paying each time you need a service like that, or you should be doing a subscription and shopping around for that. And I think that, you know, you can at the same time keep Obamacare too. Have that as an option too. If people want these plans with the rules and regulations and no exclusions and all of it, keep that too. More choice is not less. But I think if we brought back this the kind of major medical type model, and especially now with the proliferation of, you know, direct primary care as an option, I think a lot of people would find that much more attractive and save a lot of money and accumulate a lot of value over time in their HSAs.
Well, I think that's right. And again, this is what we were talking about 15 years ago, too, 16 years ago.
Well, I think we were right. I think we were right. Look, I think we tried what they wanted to do and it has not worked. And their only answer that the Democrats have is to throw more money at it. Just an endless amount of subsidy to try to keep this thing kind of, you know, limping along.
You have to increase the subsidies, because if you don't increase the subsidies, the prices are going up, the costs are going up. You know, they're using, this is the problem when you're talking about prices versus costs. But
the irony is, if you increase the subsidies, the costs go up even more, because you're getting restricted supply. They've got all these regulations restricting supply, and our answer to the prices going up is just throw more subsidy on the demand side.
And this is my point, though, is that this is the type of thing that you get when you mistake price for costs. They're trying to keep the prices low, but that doesn't really address costs. Prices are an equilibrium between you know, demand and supply, right? And value. I mean, you can throw value in there too, right? But this is when you suppress the price, and this is what they're doing, you inevitably get less supply. Demand is still going up, and you have to subsidize. You have to create subsidies one way or the other.
Because it's the worst of all worlds, because we're making it very hard for actual doctors and nurses to make a living. They're getting less.
I agree. Okay?
But we're spending more because it's going to all this massive overhead that we've created, all these layers of bureaucracy in the hospital systems and in the insurance companies. And, you know, Medicare directly incentivizes this by paying much. You know, do you know that Medicare will pay more for the same doctor's visit, literally in the same physical building, if that physician's practice gets bought by a health system? Yeah. So why do you think they're all getting gobbled up by health systems? So we've got insane payment policies. And then we've also got all of these rules and regulations that make it so difficult to be in private practice. And in many states, you can't open a clinic or a surgical center, even if you want to, and even if it makes sense, and even if there's demand, unless you get the incumbent's permission. Think about that.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. And look, I mean, the alternate to this from the left is, okay, well, we'll just do Medicare for all. it's the same problem, except that you don't even have any competition at that point. Then you have nothing but a subsidized price structure where you're going to have to dump tons of money into it to maintain the same level of service, or what usually happens in these single payer systems, government-run single payer systems, or the private single payer systems, like the HMO model that we used to have back in the 80s, is that you pay more and you get less. They just start cutting the supply out in order to keep costs down while maintaining prices at an artificially low point. And so the real solution to this is exactly what it was 16 years ago, which is a strictly market-based product where insurance is only for hospitalization and catastrophic events, and everything else is done on a clear price signaled equilibrium, right? And that's how you get more providers, how you get more general practice doctors into the market, is to give them an opportunity to.
And I think you can do that. Jobs. If you do that through the HSAs, you can do it without people losing the tax benefit, which is the big concern in a lot of these reform plans in the past. They say, oh my God, you're going to tax people's healthcare, which of course is not what we're trying to do. But the supply piece, I think, has become even more important over time because of the consolidation trend we've seen. And so, you know, I think it's great to fix the payment model and, you know, the stuff that we've been talking about for a long time. But now I think even more important is to reverse these consolidation drivers so that it's a viable business model for you know, doctors and nurses to have some independence again if they want it.
So, Phil, let me ask you this. I mean, one of the things that we're hearing from the administration now that they're negotiating on this, I think they took the right tack. We're not negotiating anything until after you guys reopen the government. That worked. Now they're going to talk about this. And that's fine that they're talking about it. I don't mind having negotiations on public policy. I prefer that to shutdowns. But what they're saying, what we're hearing from the White House is, well, we're going to extend the subsidies, but we're not going to send it to the insurance companies. We're just going to send the money directly to consumers. Now, that might be a little better, but I think it's still playing basically on the same field. I don't know how you need do
to
have
there needs to be more to it. If all you do is say the money can still only be used for your choice of Obamacare plans, but now we're going to route it through an account that you control, and then you're going to choose which plan you want and it's going to go to them, it will be a distinction without a difference. I think the key
is that's what I was thinking too.
You've got to at the same time increase the choices that and the purposes for which the money can be spent, and that's very, very important. And you know, I get the desire to negotiate with Democrats, but I'm skeptical that anything that's actually directionally useful on healthcare will come through a bipartisan bill. I think they should be warming up another run at the reconciliation process. And that does present a lot of problems because a lot of the things we want to do are kind of regulatory, and you know, the parliamentarians not going to allow them. But if I were them, I would be trying to figure out the smartest, cleverest ways to get permission from the parliamentarian to do the things that are directionally useful under that process. Because I think the best healthcare bill we can get under the current circumstances is one that would be partisan, even if that means it gets Swiss cheesed by, you know, bird rule, as opposed to trying to work out a deal with Democrats. Because what I think Democrats are trying to do is not get something positive done on healthcare. They're trying to transfer blame for the collapse of their own Obamacare system to Republicans. I think that's what the last the shutdown was about.
Absolutely. Totally agree with you on that. Here's the problem for people who really want to see a substantial reform is that Republicans can't even agree amongst themselves how to do this. This came up 8 years ago. They had an opportunity, right? This is John McCain famously voting it down on the Senate floor and sort of, you know, driving a spike through it out of, you know, in a fit of pique, I think is a fair assessment of this. But to be honest with you, and we were talking about it at the time, the plan that they had put together wasn't really a plan anyway.
Do you remember the famous quote from Pat Toomey when he was asked why they didn't have a plan? And he said, oh, we thought Hillary was going to win. Maybe that's why he's not, why he retired.
I like Pat Toomey, but yes, I think that's a good assessment. Although I like Pat Toomey. Pat Toomey is a fun guy. The issue is that they won't commit to a fully market plan, right? They won't leverage the power of markets to deal with this because it is politically dangerous for them to do so. And even Donald Trump doesn't want to do that. He wants a plan, but he doesn't.
There's some very challenging public choice challenges here. In particular, look, the consolidation trend I was talking about, one of the implications of that is the biggest employer in pretty much every congressional district is a hospital system now.
Yeah.
And the last thing they want is more competition and more choice and more transparency. And so you've got the basic mechanics of how kind of lobbying and influence works makes it very, very difficult to do this. But I mean, there is a little bit of cause for optimism. We got some pretty significant Medicaid reforms earlier this year, including capping state-directed payments to hospitals and Medicaid at the Medicare rate. And, you know, hospitals hated that. And they did have to do a $50 billion compensation fund for rural hospitals as sort of the price for getting the bill over the finish line. But, you know, they did take a chunk out of these big hospital systems, which to me is some cause for optimism that these guys may be willing to advance good policy, even if they get an earful from, you know, maybe the biggest employer in their district for most of them. And so, you know, I think the problems have become acute enough that maybe we can get to consensus and, you know, we'll see, maybe not, but as I said, I'm skeptical they can actually do something directionally correct as on a bipartisan basis. So if I were them, I'd be warming up a budget resolution and at least getting the wheels in motion to do a healthcare bill by reconciliation.
All right. Well, Phil Kirpin of American Commitment, AmericanCommitment.org, I believe. And anything else on the horizon that you want us to be looking at here briefly as we wrap things up?
No, I mean, I think
this is pretty much it. Right?
Healthcare is the big one right now. So, you know, obviously they're going to have appropriations also, and I hope we don't go back into shutdown at the end of January. But for now, at least, this is pretty much what I'm focused on.
I suspect that they're going to quietly pass the rest of the appropriation bills and kick the can or kick the can down the road another time. I may not live to see the next regular order budget get passed in both chambers of Congress. Anyway, Phil Kirpin, at Kirpin still, right, on Twitter? Still on Twitter?
My last name,
At Kirpin, K-E-R-P-E-N. And Phil Kirpin is at AmericanCommitment.org. And you can go check out all the good work that they're doing over there. Phil, thank you so much for bringing us up to date and shining a little light on what this issue is really about.
Thanks, Ed. My pleasure. Have a good one.